For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she, too, can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Long Form Podcast. I'm Max Linsky, and I'm here with Evan Ratliff and Aaron Lemmer. Hello, gentlemen.
It's a pleasure.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Evan. Aaron, who did you interview this week?
I interviewed Natasha Vargas Cooper, who I have been an unabashed fan of her writing for some time. She's someone who's really come up while we've been doing long form. I think the first thing I saw from her was The All, and now she's writing all over the place.
I'm really excited to hear this interview. I have not listened to it yet, but I did see Aaron directly after it was recorded, and you had like no color in your face. You were pretty pale.
It was far and away the longest recording session we've ever done for this podcast. I think that record will stand.
I got the sense that you guys got real too.
It was 2.5 hours of unfiltered audio, which is in a condensed format. I won't give anything away other than that, but this is a good one. Check it out. And also check out our sponsor, tinyletter.com. Tiny Letter is a simple, powerful way to send an email newsletter from the good people at MailChimp. We thank them for their support.
Wait, I have something else.
Yes, you have something new.
Wait, who is that?
There's a new Atavist story this week, just out. It's The Legends of Last Place by Abe Streep. It's about the worst baseball team in all of professional baseball and all independent leagues, the Santa Fe Fuego.
Awesome.
Here's me and Natasha.
Hello, Natasha Vargas Cooper.
Hi.
We are in sunny Los Feliz. Am I saying that right?
Yes, Los Feliz.
How is it going, Natasha?
Oh my God. Great.
Yes.
I mean.
You told me you're coming from a courthouse.
I am. I'm writing about a murder trial involving some Marines who kind of misbehaved and killed another Marine and his wife.
How long have you been on this story?
About 2 weeks.
2 weeks. Okay. And how long ago did these murders take place?
2008.
So you've written from the courthouse before.
Yes.
What was your first trial? What was the first trial that you spent in the house?
My first trial was the murder trial for Nick Markowitz, where they captured Jesse James Hollywood. And that was up in Santa Barbara. And the reason why I started covering that was because I grew up with Nick and he was a very close friend of mine. And the murder kind of ripped apart our whole, that happened when we were 15 going on 16. So it was a really kind of formative experience and touched everyone's, in my close circle's life. Some people were kind of never the same. It caused a lot of trauma. And so he was on the run for 10 years. And so when he first got captured by the FBI.
In Brazil, right?
In Brazil.
Yeah.
I was Nick Markowitz's parents and my best friend Ryan, who was also best friends with Nick, went to Santa Barbara to watch him being brought into jail. And Ryan asked me to come with him. So I was there for that. And it's just, you know, it's as high stakes as you can get. I was curious from my own point, I just wanted to know all about the trial, but also just as I wanted to write about serious stuff. And I was like, well, this is as serious as it gets. And I know all of the details and I live the details. So I'm just going to write about it. And I asked Corey and Alex at the AWL, I was like, can I just write about this for you? And they said, yeah. And so I did that. I went to Santa Barbara every day for several months and just wrote for free.
So at that point, I mean, I wouldn't even know, I don't think, how to get into a courthouse as a reporter.
You literally walk in.
You just walk in, right?
You just walk in. The only trials that are difficult to get to are things that concern sexual assault and minors. Otherwise,
can you get into those at all?
Those are harder. Those you have to go through a much more, like, you have to talk with the judge and he can kind of pick and choose who can be there. Generally, it's not open to public. They'll have press conference afterwards, but it's actually, I mean, this is one of the wonderful things about living in a democratic society is you can just walk in and just sit there.
But we can't ban guns.
I mean, that's the trade-off, you know, you can have a gun.
But okay. So when you say that, let's take the Jesse James Hollywood, this trial lasted over a period of months.
Yeah.
Are you in court every day?
I try to go to court every day. Some days, court is in session from Monday to Thursday, generally. And I try to go every day. Sometimes I would pick up other assignments or whatever and wouldn't be there. But, you know, to me, it's all color and it's all like you get while there's not like necessarily grand drama to every testimony, there is just like one more element of the story that you're like, oh Jesus, oh okay. And then also just to see how the defense can take, it's fascinating to see how the same set of facts can be pushed and pulled in a way by two different sides. And also when it comes to murder trials, it's like there is not a more high stakes situation, right? Like and it is an incredibly weirdly banal and civilized proceeding. Like you, yep, in a courtroom about the size of this living room, you had people whose son was murdered and the people whose son murdered this other person's son sitting 2 feet away from each other and not killing each other. Which,
are you allowed to audio record the thing? Okay. And no. But you can get the transcript from court.
You can
eventually
get transcripts, but that's very expensive.
Really?
That's
not a matter of public record?
No. They have to photocopy it. And they have to do it through a court reporter. And the court reporter is already underpaid and overworked. And so it's like more work for them.
Really?
So some lawyers will be great and will say, if you want to come to my office and read the transcripts, you can.
Yeah.
So that's good. I mean, you know, and also when I went to the Jesse James Hollywood trial, I didn't identify as press. I just went as a citizen. And did not try to come at it from a journalistic perspective because I was too close to the case. I thought from the beginning that Jesse James Hollywood should be put in jail for life, not death penalty, but because I'm opposed. But you know, like I was completely emotionally tied to the case. And was in the tank, as they say. So I didn't even come thinking. I mean, I took notes. I did all the things. But, like, I never put on the air of, like, I'm a journalist doing this in a serious way. I just quit my job working for a union and had just, you know, was like, oh, I'm going to try this. And it was like, this is something that compels me. So I'm just going to do it.
And did you, when you quit that job, were you thinking, I'm going to keep doing this, I'm going to come up with new stories? I mean,
yeah, I mean, when I managed, based on the cyclical work of campaigning, there was several months towards the end of my job where I just wasn't really doing much, and so I was like blogging all the time, and like Alex Balk and Corey Asika were working at Radar, and I was like, here's a story, here's this, here's that, and I was like, and so actually, like, I had built this whole kind of freelance career while I was still working, and so I saved up $10,000 from my job and said, okay, I'm just going to write until the money runs out.
And how long did that get you?
Well, I spent 6 weeks in New York and was like, this is a fucking shit show. I'm not going to be here any longer because I don't want to live like a peasant in poverty. So I left after 6 weeks. I made great friends and contacts, and the people that I met there are still very helpful to me, but and people I care a lot about. But it was just like, this is not the place for me to thrive. I cannot be worried about. I cannot walk in the snow to get fucking groceries at the Brooklyn Co-op and like be a happy person.
And I can't do shifts at the Brooklyn Co-op to save my life because they banned me.
What'd you do?
I didn't show up too much.
What a horrible. You are what's ruining the collective spirit of Brooklyn.
It's really true, actually. It was a wake up call to me when I realized that I was not fit to be part of a cooperative society.
Well, I just wouldn't leave the house for 4 days because it was cold, and like I'm not into like I like my car, and I'm not into like public spaces. I live in Los Angeles. Like, I think that's great for other people and like really democratic and wonderful. But like, oh, too much promiscuous mingling of different people around me. So I just like wouldn't leave the house. And then when I would, I'd go out with like other writers and editors and would drink a lot. And then I'd be like, oh, I'm getting drunk around the people who give me work. This is terrifying. So I went home and moved in with my parents.
Let's come back to that,
yes,
as a theme. So that story came out, and I assume after that story was sort of the first time you were pitching people.
Oh God, extensively. No.
No? Okay.
Not really. I mean, I did not really start pitching people until maybe a year and a half ago. So I got a dog on my way home. I drove cross country from Brooklyn to Los Angeles and was definitely like, I don't know, like Eat, Pray, Loving or whatever. I haven't read the book, but I imagine I was just like, I was just sad and alone.
Eat, Pray, Loving through the Midwest.
Through the Midwest and through the South, through Natchez, Mississippi and through Jackson. And so I was driving, and I think after like 4 days in Louisiana, I was just like, oh, I just like left a boyfriend of 5 years who I thought I was going to marry, and I quit my job, and I knew I was moving back in with my parents. And in Louisiana, I was like, oh, I need a small dependent creature that's going to love me unconditionally. And I walked into a pet store, and I was like, that one. And I took the dog home, and the dog gave me all my routine. It's the reason why I got up in the morning. It's the reason why I bathed, and the reason. And then one night I went out and I came home and it was gone. And I slipped into like a deep, dark depression. And then I was like, I'm just going to medicate by watching Mad Men. And so I started watching Mad Men and not sleeping and just compulsively blogging. And then about 3 weeks later, I got a call from HarperCollins and like, do you want to write a book? And I had just started my career as a writer about 2 months prior. So I was like, sure. So I had 30 days to write a book.
30 days.
30 days. I pushed that shit to 45 days, though.
I think a lot of people might be interested. How do you write a book in 30 to 45 days?
You don't. I would wake up at 6 p.m. I hired two researchers to sit in front of me, and I'd be like, look this up. Look at this. Come with me to the UCLA archives in like the couple days that I would work in the mornings, or in the mornings at 2 p.m. So I'd wake up at 6 p.m. I would eat, and then at around 8, I would go to a lobby of a hotel that had Wi-Fi with my two researchers who I gave a lot of my advance to, and work from 8 p.m. to 7 a.m. Hmm. with no interruption. I would send bitchy emails at 1 a.m. to people that I was upset with that helped take some of the edge off. So like boyfriends that had wronged me.
That was part. So in the middle of a 30 to 45 day book session, you were also sending angry emails.
Yeah, because that was like part of the whole catharsis, right? It was like, I'm doing this thing now and like, fuck you for never calling me back. Like, I think I wrote a guy who was like, oh, after we slept together, I feel like we should really get to know each other as friends, and like never called me. And that was the dude who I had like given my first I don't know how else to put this. Blowjob to at summer camp, and we had reconnected, and I was like, oh my God, it's my summer camp love. It's going to work. And then he just like never got in touch again, blew me off. So I think like at 1 a.m. one night, I remember like doing my manuscript and just being like, hang on a second, and just writing him. I was like, you're a real cunt. And that was it. And it just made me feel great. I was just like closing doors, slamming doors. This is my new life. So then also like spending weekends locked in a hotel in Palm Springs, a lot of hotels because I live with my parents. I was also on probation.
Do you want to talk about that?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Why are you on probation? You've seen the courthouse from every angle.
I've been in jail, brother. I was on my way to a booty call at 2 a.m. He kept pushing it back, and I kept getting kind of more upset, and I was out with friends, and so I was like, oh, I'm going to have another glass of Pinot Gris, and knocked it back, and then finally at like 2:30 when I was on my way to...
This is kind of a hazard of living in Los Angeles, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I have 6 friends who have DUIs. It's but I will say that out of those 6, I think 4 of us... I mean, I got sober after that. I don't drink anymore. So I was speeding down the 10, And I was like, oh, Lady Gaga. Yeah, Lady Gaga came on. And then the cops were behind me. And then within like, they were like, okay, we're going to breathalyze you. I was like, all right. I blew. And then within, I think, less than a second, I was in handcuffs. And I will say that there was an instant urge to run. Did I was like, I'll just run. I'll just run. And I don't know where I'm going.
Did the breathalyzer make like a beeping noise?
No, you have no idea. They just go, okay, breathe into this. And I'm like, whew. And they're like, all right. And then like, just take your hand.
Whoa.
And you're just like, oh, I can explain. And I wasn't even that drunk, but it was enough. I'm a short girl, and two glasses will put you over. So then I got put into Van Nuys. This was the weekend I signed my book deal. And so I felt kind of invincible.
Yeah.
And so I got booked into Van Nuys with a bunch of, they had just done a prostitution sting. And there was about 18-year-old black hookers, one named Passion, one named Keisha. So I was booked in, and at first I thought, well, like, oh, this is really anthropological and interesting and whatever. And then it just all really kind of started to sink in because I was like, I need to pee. They're like, there's a toilet right there. And it was like in front of 26 other people. And I was like, oh, so that was a wake up call. It helped that I was on probation. So I couldn't drive for the first 60 days. And yeah. That was when my book was due. So I'd have my researcher pick me up, and I would go to AA meetings because I had to, and I wanted to. They were good. And then I wrote my book, and I finished it 2 weeks late. That was it.
You got a lot of energy.
Duh.
How did you channel all of that energy into – your writing is actually quite composed.
Oh, thank
you. And you often pick stories that I feel like are kind of like a – I guess I'd describe as kind of a long grind.
Yes.
I wouldn't identify your work with like, oh, that's an easy one. I'm just going to go for it.
Yeah.
Like, when I think of something like court reporting, actually, you're generally reporting on stuff that you don't know the outcome of going in, which could like
which
make or break the story.
Which makes it difficult for people to accept your pitch.
Let's get to that. But yes. What attracts you to those as stories, and how did you learn how to structure mm-hmm. a reporting and writing experience based on that kind of stuff?
Well, I like things that are high stakes. I don't like writing, even though I have a book, I don't like writing about television. I don't like writing about pop culture. It's just about showing off how clever you are. And I definitely consume it. I mean, the biggest influence on me as a writer is probably Pauline Kael, right? But also George Orwell. So it's like, so I naturally have always gravitated towards like low lives and hustlers and addicts. And it's just like kind of marginal existences. So I like seek those stories out. And so it just, and those stories by their nature are long, right? Because these like crimes and transgressions and these kind of high-stakes situations, unless you're maybe in war, don't just pop up, right?
It's funny when we've the database of long form is sorted by tags and categories, mm-hmm. and people always ask sort of what's the most popular or whatever, and people have these perceptions.
What is
crime
it?
Is yes! way, like, crime is like half the stories.
Really? That's great to hear. That's really great to hear.
And I don't think that's a taste issue. I actually think that's what... crime is what sort of unifies our interests.
Oh, yeah.
And you really, you'd be hard fought to find someone who's really not interested in crime.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's everything, right? It's like you have the stakes, you have the characters, you have the wish fulfillment of you know, wanting to do this. But also, like it really is sometimes, you know, oh, fuck, what's the phrase there? There by the grace of God go I. Whereas like there's certain things where you're like, oh, like if I had one fucked up stepdad, right? Or if I had one fucked up uncle, I would be where some of these people are, right? And so it's like, you know, I'm also attracted to stories about social justice, but there's just people who can write better about it, you know? And my real, you know, to me, when I was active in social justice, it was like the writers didn't mean shit. It was people who were going door to door, knocking, organizing, building structures. So it's like, to me, I know that writing about social justice, you know, and that is to say, like, you know, for example, when the Pulitzers came out, my favorite stories that came out of that were the daycare stuff from Minnesota,
yeah.
right? Like, I get, like, that moves policy and moves legislation, but, you know, it's like, I'm not really, like, out seeking justice, and that doesn't motivate my work. What motivates my work and what motivates going on these longer dives, these long stories, is, like, I'm really fascinated by pathologies and when they kind of mix with the normal world. Because those, I don't know, it's just transgression is so compelling. And just, and when it all gets caught up with each other, and it usually has a bigger place and a bigger time, because if there's a certain drug involved or a certain crime involved or certain, it's like, it's just a great, what you have are these small slices that tell a much bigger story.
So I think the most recent sort of crime story, and yeah. I'm not sure I'd quite classify it as a crime story that you've done, is you did a story about the 10-year-old who killed his neo-Nazi father.
Yes.
And you did that for BuzzFeed.
Yes. Yeah.
So in taking on something like that that was already a pretty widely reported story, not in terms of a in-depth story, but in terms right. of sort of a news hook, like there was coverage of it on CNN when it happened. When you decided to take that story on,
mm-hmm.
what are the sort of moves you make to get what you need for a story like that?
Oh, it's literally like the number one thing is just having someone with a budget who trusts you. That's literally it. Like, I, without even going to court, I was like, here are the details of the case. I'm a great writer. Give me this assignment. Right? Because, like, how is that not compelling, right? Like,
sure.
The facts of the case are so great, right? And fortunately, Steve Kandel at BuzzFeed is a risk taker and is like...
Check out his long-form podcast.
Hey, yeah. Is, like, is willing to take some risk and doesn't... And BuzzFeed doesn't have the built-in neurosis of a lot of other magazines that are, like, you know, kind of, like, deciding by committee and all this other stuff. Like, mm-hmm. Steve just kind of wants good quality shit. So that's really it. Like, it was literally like, here's this story. I've been reading about it. I think I can do a really good job on reporting it. Here's my plan. I'm going to go to Riverside. I'm going to talk to this. I'm going to talk to the DA. I'm going to talk, you know. Yeah. I will say that part of organizing is that, like, I am not nervous talking to people. Yeah. I'm fearless about it. I enjoy doing it. It's the favorite. Writing is the worst part of this gig for me. I hate fucking writing. I hate sitting down and writing. It's being with my worst self. It's me at my worst moods. It's me at my most. It's like... David Rakoff wrote about it, where it's like, it's the opposite of cooking. Like, nothing is edible and you're just all putting it together, or like an infant crying. It's just like, and it's just shit beaming back at me. Like, I fucking hate these sentences. But then when it's over, it's like the best. Like, I have no greater joy than reading what I've published, with the exception of some editors that have fucked up my shit. But, like, you know, it's just like, oh, this is fucking great. And then being on a story, interviewing the people, watching it unfold, building relationships, right? Because I have no fucking neutrality, right? Like,
Yeah. It's
all relationship building. Not in a kiss-assy way, but it's just like, I respect what the DA is doing. I respect what the defense attorney is doing. I talk to them like adults. I have questions, but I think they're doing incredible work. It's moving work, you know? So it's like, that's the great part. Writing is the worst. Anyone who said, people who are like, oh, I just love to write. I'm like, you're fucking deranged. This is the worst experience. I hate it.
So in terms of dealing with the DA and with the attorneys and stuff like that, how do you sort of earn someone like that's trust?
Oh, just pure personality. I mean, look, I had to explain, like, I'm from BuzzFeed. Here's the deal. We have been doing cat lists for a while, but we got venture capital money, and this is one of our first big stories. I've written for the New York Times, GQ, Spin, Atlantic, you know, and I got hired to do this.
Yeah.
I'm also not a fucking schmuck, and, like, I portray a certain level of intelligence and charisma. So it's easy.
It sounds hard, but...
I mean, I'm sure it's hard for people who are, like, awkward music writers.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, but, like, the hardest part is just being, like, a functional social human being, so...
So in terms of taking that sort of raw material and turning that into a story, when you first started doing that, did you have models for, did you look at other writers? I mean, how do you put together that first story?
Oh my God. I mean, do you want to get processy?
I'll go there.
Oh, Jesus. I do everything. I take all notes by hand, right?
Yes.
And then I type those up. No, I mean, look, and then I type those up, and then I write, and then I gun through a draft, and I just take it, and I'm just like, oh, this is terrible, get to the next paragraph. Oh, this is horrible, get to the next paragraph.
Yeah.
And I set how many words I need to write a night. I only have 4.5 hours of writing in me a day. I can't do more than that.
I like that you know to the half hour, not to the hour.
No, it's exact. It's my limit. It's from 8 to midnight to 12:30. So I read. I do so much reading and over preparing. So when I was doing the Jesse James Hollywood trial, I reread In Cold Blood. When I always read Norman Mailer. I've been reading, you know, it's like I dig canon. If you were to ask me, like, who are my favorite contemporary journalists?
Who are your favorite contemporary journalists?
I could maybe name two. I don't know. Like,
who are your favorite two?
Caitlin Flanagan and Ben Schwartz. Lance. I mean, those are the people who, like, no matter what they write, I will read.
Yep.
Like, I think David Grant is great. I remember reading David Grant's Trial by Fire, and I was like, okay, I want to do this. This is the type of work I want to do. Because I was kind of like writing about TV. I was kind of writing like, I mean, I make most of my money from doing celebrity profiles.
Right.
Which is like the worst.
So you have no respect for the celebrity profile.
I do. I do when it's actually done. I mean, celebrity profiles don't have access. You're given 20 minutes in a room and it's like, go. And their publicist is right there. And it's this, I listened to Molly Young's thing. It's a completely inauthentic experience. Yeah. You're both lying. It was perfect. It's humiliating for both people in the room. And then on occasion you actually get access and it's really fascinating.
Yeah.
Like Dr. Drew, who I did, or Out Magazine has given me these great access to people who are not hugely famous.
Right.
So, and they just, I can just hang around them for days. And it's like, wow, you're fucking fascinating actual human beings rather than the kind of pop constructed persona that you're engaging with and that you're just making up. Like I've gotten assignments from magazines that have been like, they've said like, this person is on our cover, right? They said, you know, write a story. And what you always hope for in these cases is that you can just do a Q&A, right? Because it's less work for you. Yeah. And you're like, okay, well, this person is compelling enough that you put them on your cover. They actually like answer the question sincerely. Here is the Q&A. And I was told, you writing about this person is more compelling than this person, which I realize is not like, you're like, oh, what's the big insight? But like that like never occurred to me. It's like, oh, I thought you were putting this person on your magazine cover because you found them interesting. I don't, but you do. But no, it's like, no, we actually have this whole other narrative about them. That you didn't get in the interview, but we can reconstruct. And, you know, they're like the single it girl who's now making it, or like the embattled director, even though that had nothing to do with the content of the interview. But like, that is what we've already designed this around. So just go do that. And I was like, oh, that's how this works, you know?
So you do that for money.
Yes.
And is that that's your
that
paycheck?
Helps.
Yeah.
Because those are quick. Those are just quick and dirty. Those are just like, I don't know how many hand jobs a hooker gives out a night, but I assume it's the bread and butter. So it's like, these are just hand jobs? Yeah, I don't know. Do people, I guess because they're cheap and easy and fast? Handjays?
Are a lot of men paying for hand jobs?
I hope not. I don't know what men pay for.
I feel like I'd pay not to get a hand job.
Oh my God.
Whoa. Explosion.
Yes.
Hold on. I timed that well.
Yes. Heyo. Don't mess up these floors.
We're back.
Yes.
We're moving past hand jobs.
Yeah, I mean,
we'll agree to disagree about the value of a hand job.
Yes, but what I'm saying is that like those are quick and easy and they pay well.
Yeah.
Whereas like, you know, the amount of time I spend on a crime story reporting and thinking and expenses, I lose, you know.
You literally lose money.
Mostly.
Wow. So this is literally a labor of love for you then.
Yeah. Even if I publish three, let's say I publish, it's closer to three features a year.
Yeah.
That's $15,000. That's it.
Yeah.
If that. I mean, I made between $25,000 and $30,000 last year. I might as well be a fucking school teacher, you know? And even then I would get healthcare. I don't have healthcare. So it's like, I haven't unlocked it yet. I haven't quite figured it out yet. You know, I was like, okay, I'm going to grow up and be, like when I started writing, I'm going to grow up and be Christopher Hitchens. And then Hitchens died and I don't really know who's taking his place. And I don't know if those jobs exist anymore, you know, and I think it's all reshuffling as we know. And like, it's definitely more democratic and I've made a living out of writing in and for the internet, you know, and I've been lucky enough to get kind of lucky. Fuck this. These are like horrible conglomerates who could absolutely afford to pay me more and like don't, you know. And there's some people who have like who have a lot of talent and are also charmed and get these kind of big pieces and can kind of just say like, I have this great story, publish me, you know, and they get them. Or like Ariel Levy is fantastic, you know, or David Grant, like these, you know, but there's like 14 of them.
Yeah.
Right? Like we could, you and I could name all of the people who make kind of a prestigious living at being long form feature writers.
You can find most of them on longform.org. no, I think that's accurate, but I mean, is it getting better? Like do you have optimism?
There are a couple, I will actually say this, there are about 3 editors out there who I hope they keep being editors because they pay me and they fight for me and they give me work. But literally my faith is in those 3 people.
How did you develop, so one of those relationships is someone who was your teacher, how did you develop the relationships with the editors that you do like working with? Like,
I just pitch them.
Yeah.
I'm good, I mean like I'm pretty good at pitching. I'm constantly having stories in my head. Here's what I will say is like why I feel like I belong doing this. When I'm not writing, as much as I hate writing, all I'm doing is read. Like all I do is read longform.org all day. Honestly, it's all I do. It's like, oh, I have an hour to kill. What do I need to catch up on? Like I have the archive subscription to Harper's, which has like changed my life. You know, it's like all I do is kind of consume this, and I've been able to be like, this is what's good. This, I mean, look, it's also like I'm constantly stealing. I'm like, oh, that's a great adjective. Oh, that's a great structure. You know, like
do you take notes on all this stuff? I mean, you're like,
I'll rip stuff out and paste it into a little notebook I have, or like, Evernote has changed my life. So all of this to say is like, I will spend about 4.5 hours a day for 10 days at a time writing straight. And that's when I'm like in the worst, most depressed mood. And
where do you get, so when you said that you're like constantly reading, what I thought you were going to say is that you're constantly looking for story ideas. So where are you getting the leads for these stories?
Associated Press. Yeah. Just, I read the Wire. I read the Wires all the time, and it's like, and the local Wires. So it's like, I really have to recommend the A. Oh, now I feel like I'm giving away my secrets. But
that's what this podcast is all about. Tell us all your secrets.
Yeah. So the Associated Press app is great, and it just structures the local stories in a great way. And so because I have connections in Riverside, it's like I know almost every crime that goes to trial, because I also have a relationship with the DA. So I'm also sent like, here's a press release. Here's what we're doing this week.
Are you a narc?
Yeah, duh. it's like, I also have like, I'm friendly with the LAPD. So it's like, I know who to track. Yeah. And so I'm like, this is a story and I know I can get access to it.
So I'm interested knowing that you're on the AP Wire, which you just gave up your secret. But probably it wasn't.
But you know what? Can I just say?
Yeah.
I don't feel like I have that much competition at my level in the sense of like people. I like these are long, hard stories to report.
But I do feel like increasingly, actually, particularly with the sort of rise of the web where everyone's like writing in the same space. Right. There was a period of time where it's like, oh, 2 of the same story in 2 different magazines. Oh, well, whatever. No one cares.
Right.
You see stories now, like I'm thinking of like that story of the guy who let out his like exotic zoo, you know?
Great.
And Chris Heath. I think Chris Jones and Chris Heath both did it. So knowing that, I sort of wonder whether like your best ideas, do you go, oh shit, someone else is on this probably too?
Sometimes, but it doesn't matter because I feel like here really comes ready for the swagger.
Swag it.
I'm a very elegant writer.
Yeah.
And I have a very particular voice and a very, I just yeah. I'm going to write it first because I work cheaper and yeah. I work for the web.
Yeah.
So for instance, GQ is going to run a story on Joseph Hall. They really? Were at the trial.
This is the neo-Nazi yeah. story. Yes.
That's going to come out in July.
And you knew about that while you were writing mm-hmm. that someone else was.
Yeah. And I was a little concerned about it, but you know, I play a different game.
Well, I'm sort of interested because you have, the stories you have done are sort of split between stories where you're completely outside the story. And then in the case yes. of that Atlantic story, you do appear in the yes. story. And that story is about pornography. Well, sorry, what inspired you to write about pornography in the first place?
Ben Schwartz called me and was like,
"You love porn."
He was like, "I have the piece that's going to make your career." And I was like, "Give it to me." Because what had happened for a year is that I had just written under him at UCLA. Yep. And I got an A+ in both my classes and just took every assignment he gave really seriously because I was in it with, I was a history and public policy major, but I was in it with a bunch of literature or English majors who were just shitty and stupid and were like, Dickens and Victorian, blah, blah, blah.
I was an English major.
Well, you guys are insufferable. But I will say that the best classes I took at UCLA were English classes. But we were studying nonfiction.
Yeah.
So it was like, I was super absorbed by it and was very into it. So I had somewhat proven myself through doing so much work in these classes. And like, he had known that I was trying to like start and freelance. He's like, look, you're the perfect person to write this. Here's what I want to know. Why is it acceptable for women to do doggy style on the first night of having sex? And I was like, it's unacceptable. Who doesn't do doggy style?
Who says that?
Yeah. Well, people who grew up in a different time. So he's like, get to the bottom of that. And so that started a year process where I got that call about a month before I got my book deal. So even like through doing the book, I was always thinking about it. I also like had my year of like sexual nihilism of like, just bring it. Let's see what we can do. And just like, you know, got to the heart of darkness.
Was that part of the research?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, not really, but it was just like, it was lived experience. It was like Lena Dunham 1.0.
When you were doing your research for that story, did you know that you would appear in the story?
No.
That your own experiences were?
No, I mean, look, I gave one very telling experience.
Yeah, but it's very, but it like really stands out because yeah. it's in a piece of nonfiction.
Yeah, about, and it was great because like they were right before we'd gone through several drafts and Ben brought it to the Atlantic and they were like half. It was one of the most polarizing pieces. Some of the copy editors were like, "We're against this piece," so it was great, right? And he was like, "Some of the people are asking if you were molested," and I was like, "No, silly." But he's like, "Look, I'm just gonna say this for you, because Ben's known me for a long time and he's friends with my dad. He's like, are you okay with this piece, with this detail?" If you had kids and they read it. And I was like, oh, come on. I was like, my kids reading me in the Atlantic? Sounds fucking great. Yeah, like,
good luck with that.
Right. And but it's also very calculated. It's also like, here's this one piece that strengthens my argument.
Right.
And it's just, that's it. And it's just there. But
were you concerned that, this is the piece that's going to get pulled out? People are going to talk about that.
Oh, God, no. The piece is so strong that it doesn't matter.
Really?
Yeah. I have no fear of it because I have huge confidence in my writing. So
it's what stuck with me about the piece. Though.
Oh, like, good.
That's the passage I remembered, and I wonder.
But the reason why that I think the reason why that sticks is because it just makes the point.
Yeah.
That I'm arguing in the piece, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not an aside. It's not like a cheeky whatever. It's that it is a personal anecdote that sums up the entire thesis,
right?
Which is that men will always push further.
Yeah.
But also, like, I knew at some point that I had a natural authority in talking about this because I'm a woman and I've a woman of the world and I went to jail and I've slept with dudes and, like, you know, a lot of these fucking, like, blogger feminists who've been in fucking relationships for 6 years and are not out on the fucking sexual market, who are not dealing with the kind of existential dread of not having intimacy, because that's what the piece is also about, is sex, what sex is like without the buffer of intimacy in a relationship and what that world is and how pornography is actually a very accurate representation of it, rather than like kind of some of the slate writers who are like, it's like science fiction, or like the kind of alt edgy girls who are like, it's empowering. It's like, no, it's fucking Hobbesian. It's dispiriting, right? But that's always what it's been. That's always what it'll continue to be. And women are complicit in it, and some women like it and whatever, and that's fine. But like, sex is in general not an uplifting experience. And it's scary, right? And that's because we get pregnant, because we get abortions, because we get raped, all of this stuff, right? And like, porn either amplifies those things or doesn't. But I felt complete confidence in saying that because I've been in that market. I've been in that. That's been my lived experience for years, and nobody can take that away from me. It's the same. It's the confidence that comes from watching a movie and being like, I know exactly what I felt about this. Like, I don't need to bring in any other text or any other experience. I sat through Spring Breakers and I know exactly what it made me feel, and I know exactly what that, you know, and there's no other thing because I had this experience with it. And I just bet that same level of like confidence to, and like authority to this piece. And of course, I think that I had to show my bona fides and be like, this is, I know it.
Do you ever experience doubt?
Oh God, all the time. Writing is all the, that's why writing is so terrible. That's where all the doubt is. That's where all the rewrites are. That's where, but that's also where I learned that, like, unfortunately, I'm a better writer on the eighth draft. I always wanted to be a one draft writer. Like, I'll just go sentence by sentence. It'll be fucking great. But it takes me eight drafts. And so, you know, it's like, that's where all the doubt and hesitation comes out. But I know the thing I turn in is the thing I'm the most confident about. And then once it's been minted and the invoices come in, then I stand behind all my work.
Do you ever want to...
That's why blogging is so terrible. That's why I don't like it.
Because it's a first draft art form.
It's all first draft. It's all sloppy. It's all immediate. It's all like, I haven't really had the time to like, I mean, other people are great at it. I think that like Corey and Alex are like geniuses at it. And there's definitely people who just have that art. I don't have that set of muscles, and I'm not interested in developing it.
When you look back, like, are you trying to build a body of work?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I'll ever have like a singular piece. Like, I mean, like there's Krakauer, right? I think Into Thin Air is a masterpiece. I've probably read it four times. Like, yeah. I just come back to that book because it's like, oh, it's so raw and it's so intense. And it's just like, and you know, he has that masterpiece, but he also has a very great body of work. And to a degree, if it weren't for God Is Not Great, Hitchens would also just, I mean, that's the critique on him, right? It's like, he's not really a stylist. He just has like he's prolific and has this really great body of work. So I am, you know, if a publisher wants to pay me $200,000 to write a book, I'm not going to turn them down, but I would just like to live a, middle class lifestyle and make 60 grand a year and live in the San Fernando Valley.
When I look at a piece like, that bath salt piece you did, I'm sort of struck by, I don't know if bath salts will exist in 5 or 10 years. Hope not, but
it's kind of a placeholder, though. Like, I feel like even if bath salts, that specific synthesis won't, like, that synthesis of drug won't exist, something else will pop up.
Well, and I wonder, because I read a lot of archival stuff. So I, like, you know, I read weird, like, Crawdaddy stories from the 70s. That guy just died, sadly, actually. But you know, that really feel like, wow, whether this piece is great or okay or whatever, I'm like, it's good that someone was writing about this at the time, because actually it's, some of this stuff has been swallowed by history. I'm thinking actually of this piece. I think it was actually in Rolling Stone, now that I'm thinking about this cult in Boston, the Lyman family. Highly recommend it if you ever read it. But I was thinking, like, this literally, like, if this piece hadn't existed, this is an unnotable cult that would have just sunken under the water. And I think that's sort of about, like, you know, that bath salts reporting, that's something that actually could just come and go and not be worked on.
Well, that's also the thing with the pornography thing, which is like, this may all change, but I fucking nailed it right now.
Yeah. So when you're working on that bath salts piece, how do you think, when you think about something that's timely in that way and is like rapidly evolving and is poorly understood, even by the people who sell it, how do you freeze time around a story like that? How do you go about that?
I mean, it definitely helps when I look around and I say, no one else is writing this.
Yeah.
And so I get to make up the game as I go, right? And be like, here's the narrative on it. And there is you know, like, to put it in terms of Everest, right, where it's like, why did you climb the mountain? Because it's there, right? It's like, yeah. Well, no one's written it, so I'm going to write it, and it's going to be definitive. It's twofold. In purely narcissistic terms, it fulfills my needs because I feel like ultimately all politics and all desires and everything just comes down to like your own
ego,
psychological needs, right? Yeah. That's what Occupy is about.
I'm not taking the bait on that one.
Don't touch it. I mean, there's a lot of good in it and a lot of neurosis.
I didn't mean I disagreed with you.
I know.
I meant I have nothing to say about Occupy.
Well, one time we'll talk about the Internet Feminist Collective. So it fulfills that need. Also, I'm a bit of a sucker, and when I meet these people, I'm not a sap, but I am primarily a union organizer at heart, which I believe that like people are moved on the basis of human narrative and human stories. And so when I meet certain people, it really lights a fire under me of like, I want to get the story out. I want people to know about the two junkies in the hotel room, one who is 20 and has hepatitis, and that they're doing this. I want to talk about the chemists in the DEA lab. I want to talk about the 10-year-old boy. I want to talk about, and so it's like that. If it was just all my own ego and my own glory, I wouldn't be able. That wouldn't be enough because I'm not. I don't have that much of a personality disorder.
Yeah,
but coupled with the relationships that are built and the desire to be like, oh, people need to know about these foster kids, and not in doing good, but just because it's compelling. I also have supreme confidence in my taste, which I'm like, these are good stories. These are interesting. This isn't like some quirky little thing like bird watching that everyone's going to be enamored with. And it's like, you know, I mean, Franzen can write that because he's a great writer, but it's like, I don't necessarily think that I'm a really great writer. I think that I have really great ideas and I do storytelling good. I don't know how I feel about my prose. I think my prose is going to probably look radically different 10 years from now if I'm still doing this.
Is that taste, that sort of underlying taste, something you've developed over time, or did we born?
Motherfucker, you can't develop taste. It's gotten better and it's gotten more honed. And like, I definitely now know how to play the magazine game a little bit of like, you know, as obnoxious as it is for editors to say like, well, this story about this child killer is not about three things at once. I know that magazines want the three things at once thing. Or like one major magazine is like, we're not so much into complexity as we are about insanity and absurdity, right? And it's like, okay. So it's like, you know, eventually over pitching people, you find out what their fucking trip is, right?
Right.
And you find the stories that cater to them. But
I think of it in terms of taste, like Ira Glass said something that's like quoted on like 9,000 Tumblrs.
Yeah.
Which is like, when you're starting out, if you have good taste, the work that you're creating is not going to live up to your taste.
Right.
Right. There's like a disconnect. I actually tend to agree with you that taste is sort of inborn, but skill is not inborn.
No.
And if you have good enough taste, you're probably not capable of making something you think is good.
Absolutely. I mean, like the other thing is like, this is also part of the thing with reading my contemporaries is that it would cripple me with envy if I was looking up to my contemporaries. Right. And I would just be like, oh, why not me? Whereas like if I read canon, because like the other issue is like, I was a fuck up in high school and didn't really pay attention. I don't think I still haven't read The Great Gatsby.
Don't worry. It's coming out as a movie. So.
But I did do a profile on Tobey Maguire and Gatsby. So it's like, and then in college I was doing history and it was a horrible history department and a lot of really dry policy wonk stuff. So like I am just reading the canon now. And so like to me it's like, you know, I am still poring over Norman Mailer's treatment of Muhammad Ali, of Gay Talese on Frank Sinatra, of this amazing piece that ran in Life about it's what Panic in Needle Park is based on. You know, and like just like great these, and so it's like it mystifies where that talent comes from, where it's like, oh, it's from the ancients, you know, whereas like if somebody who's in my peer group can blow me away, oh God, I don't know what I would do. You know, I would just be like, oh, like, why can't I have this? And I'm also afraid of stealing from them, you know.
It's not really stealing.
No, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like, I want to keep my something kind of singular about it.
When you said if you're still doing this in 10 years,
yeah.
Where are you going? I mean, what do you want to do?
I told you I want $65,000 a year and healthcare.
You just went from 40 to 65.
40 is what I'm going for now. We're talking 10 years.
10 years.
5 years. Yeah, you know, man, I want to. I grew up middle class, and I want to continue that legacy.
Yeah,
you know,
it doesn't exist anymore.
No, right? So it's like I'm you know, and I want to maintain a readership, and I don't want, like, I don't know anything about Chris Heath, right? I don't really know anything about Jon Krakauer. I just know their work.
Yeah.
The work just really speaks for the itself. So I'd like that. I'd like that legacy.
Are you, is Los Angeles your home? And do you see this
yeah.
Do you look for stories here?
Is yes. Like... I mean, I may have to move to Riverside because that's where I'm getting all my great stories from. But ideologically and politically and like spiritually, what makes the most sense to me. Like, I think the problems of Los Angeles and the contours of the city are, it is a 20th century and 21st century. Maybe Las Vegas is the 21st century city, but it's like, to me, like New York had the 19th century and Los Angeles is the 20th century.
Really?
Absolutely. I mean, it's like, New York is an outdated model of living, you know,
sort of a European model.
Yeah. Kind of. Just like it's your public transit and it's vertical and it's all that stuff. And that's all fine and good. But it's like, we are, you know, Los Angeles is the ethereal now. It's boisterous. It's heterogeneous. You know, I don't strive for cute bistros and bookstores. I like my malls and my, you know, it's like, it's crass consumerism, but it's also like blended with like incredible architecture. And like, I think at this point, I mean, we go back and forth with Manhattan, but we are the most diverse. I mean, I don't even know if it's Manhattan anymore.
I think it's Queens.
Right. Yeah. Where it's like, it's incredibly diverse, you know, not that I care because I don't talk to anybody else. But it's just, it's my scene, you know,
yeah.
It's like, I live that ethos of, it just makes sense to me. Like, when I was in New York, I felt completely out of place.
We were talking before we started taping that you felt like you were pretty like isolated from any sort of like a writing scene here in LA. And you
didn't feel... I have no writing scene here.
So do you have peers at all? Or are you just kind of on
no.
your own tip?
I think everybody I pitch to, with the exception of Amy Wallace, who's wonderful, lives in New York.
You're just another anonymous Los
yeah,
Angeles person.
Which is great. I live for the anonymity. I think that's another thing that came from being a union organizer and also from reporting, which is like, I'm constantly shoving my nose and I'm getting people to talk to me when they don't want to talk.
Yeah.
I'm prying out intimate details in short periods of time and it's somewhat exhausting. So like, if I can make it through a whole day without talking to somebody else, I'm fucking great.
Thank you, Natasha Vargas.
Thanks, Aaron Lammer.
And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thank you very much to Natasha for sitting on the floor for upwards of 2 hours while we tape this. Thanks to our editor superior, Lauren Kirchner. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max and Evan. Always a big thanks to our sponsor, Tiny Letter, from the good people at MailChimp. We will be back next week.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.